Hey, Corey.
Hello, Jonathan. How are you?
I'm good. So there's this clip of a comic strip from the student newspaper here at Georgia Tech Technique that's posted in the wall of the copy room of our department building. We'll put a picture of it for listeners on Techstyle with this podcast. But in the first panel, there's a picture of a student sort of arduously carrying a poster board. She has a sort of annoyed expression. In a speech bubble, she's saying, "Don't ask, it's for English." This is followed by a picture of a student sitting in front of a computer. He's kind of got a scruffy beard. He sort of looks like he's slacking and playing a computer game of some sort. And he's looking over his shoulder, and as if he's just been interrupted, he's saying, "What? It's for English." Then in the third panel, there's someone dressed in a bear mascot costume who, and this seems like a true dig, is saying, "Sigh, it's for English." And finally, in the last panel, there's an image of a woman standing on one leg and seems to be balancing plates and teacups and other objects on her arms and legs saying, "It's for English."
I've seen that too. And the punchline there at the end, it's just like a disembodied text box spoken by no one that just says, "Tech school English classes are weird." And weird is bolded.
Yeah.
Which... I don't know if it's a dig, but I felt it as a dig when I first saw this comment.
Right. And I think it's that last comment that gets to this notion that Georgia Tech's English classes, as they're called, are not involved in the more familiar traditional aspects of English classes. And the other panels in the comic specify this point by illustrating that the classes are not just about reading and writing.
Yeah, that's right. And we're sort of, our pedagogy is built around multimodal communication, sort of identifying the fact that communication is not merely written, but in fact happens across multiple sensory inputs. Which leads to these non-traditional assignments.
So this is what we wanted to talk about today in this episode of The Office Hour. And specifically, we wanted to talk about projects and assignments that, as this comic illustrates, involve the production of material objects. And we might think, what does this have to do with the teaching of writing and communication? And what does building things have to do with an English class?
Yeah, we're excited to talk about this. We have two really great conversations with three of our colleagues here in the Britton Fellow who are doing just really incredible things with their students around physical objects, both as objects of critical analysis and as objects produced to communicate.
Let's get into it.
Let's do it.
So to tackle this question about building things in English classes, we are pleased to have with us our first, I guess also two guests of the Office Hour for the 2018-2019 academic year. Second year Britton Fellow Courtney Hoffman.
Hello.
And third year Britton Fellow Rebecca Fitzsimmons.
Hey.
So I admit that I had to request and bring both of you to this episode since I personally have not taught 1101 and 1102, the composition or English classes that the comic we are all looking at refers to. So I suppose I'm looking for a little bit of confirmation in some of this comic's suggestions about whether or not this is what English classes are really like here.
I mean, there's a giant ham downstairs in the storage room from a previous Britton Fellows class that she taught on To Kill a Mockingbird.
Is that what it was for?
Yeah, it's a life-size replica of the ham costume that Scout wears at the end of the book.
Gotcha. I did not think it was a ham when I first saw
it. It is a ham, and so you can imagine that the individual in the bear in this comic, instead of the bear costume, it's a ham costume, easily replaced, right? And so I do think there's maybe some truth to this.
So, okay, well, so clearly that class was the third panel of this comic. Rebecca, which panel of this comic strip are you?
Ooh, I mean, I think I have at some point, having been here for, you know, the third year Brit, and then I taught for a year here before that and did the TechCon classes, I think I have at some point been at all four of these.
Oh, wow.
I definitely have had my students do posters. I definitely have had my students watch movies and play games and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I've done the costumes.
I have not required any costumes in my classes, but I did have a student last fall wear a unicorn onesie to give a presentation with his group right around Halloween.
I did have some students in my dystopia class, their final group projects were to put together dystopia propaganda campaigns, multimodal campaigns, and I did have a couple of them come in, I guess, costume, but there were a couple of folks in that group who were all in ROTC together, so they showed up to give their presentations in, like, full military dress, which was extremely effective in terms of their, like, you know, technological, dystopian, militaristic future that they were pushing for in their presentation.
Well, so this raises a question because we asked about this. We were talking about costumes, and you all gave us a bunch of examples of students choosing to wear costumes, not being asked to wear costumes. So are Georgia Tech English classes weird, or are the students in Georgia Tech English classes weird?
I think that the classes that we offer at Tech are weird in a really awesome way, but also enable people to embrace the communication goals in unique and creative ways. Right. Is that the difference?
I would say that the fact of what we have on campus here allows them to do that in ways that I think they really enjoy. So for as much as our classes are the required classes that everybody has to take, sometimes it can be a little bit of a break from all of their coding and their AE and their physics and the chemistry lab and everything else. So when they have the chance to sort of break out of their shells a little bit, it's both a learning experience and a good time.
Yeah, and to that, and I'm looking at the table at all of these incredible artifacts with writing and other forms of communication on them. And I'm anxious to get this podcast to the part where we look at things, which is always the most exciting part of a podcast. So would you all tell us about these projects that you've brought and sort of what classes they came out of and what you're excited about with these student projects?
Sure. So what I have brought are artifacts from two projects in my Harry Potter and the Material Object class that I taught last spring. I figured, let's talk about things. We've got a huge maker culture on campus. They've got 3D printers. They've got laser engravers. They've got crazy stuff that they can use all over.
Jonathan has put on a sorting hat.
Very well-made sorting hat.
Yes.
Well, they did actually buy that.
Oh, cheaters.
Cheaters. But they did create the game pieces on this particular Wizard Wars based off of the game Avalon, or the Resistance, I think, whichever. I had a couple of those across my three sections. But James Howard actually gave a presentation in my orientation last year that talked about games that he asked his students to make. I know several other Brits had done it, so I figured there are opportunities and means for these students to do this. Let's let them go. Have a little fun. I had a game that I've taken home to my parents' house and played with my nieces over the summer that students made. So that was the game's artifact. The other artifact that I have some examples of here is my magical text artifact. And this was a semester-long project. I actually came up with the idea discussing Allison Volk's grant that she had for multimedia project art in the classroom.
That went into mine too.
Yes. So I worked with the wonderful artists and collaborators that we have on campus over at the Papermaking Museum. Jerusha Graham ran three separate workshops for my classes, two on different styles of bookmaking and one on stamp carving. I wanted to have my students have the opportunity to be able to create stamps to use if they wanted to. So the project was basically to make a book from scratch. So I gave them the means and the lessons to be able to do that. Some of them used the texts that they created in those workshops and then made their books with them. Some of them, as you can see from some of these examples, created their own with their own materials. That one is a book that my student wrote from scratch on fire magic.
Fantastically full fundamentals of fire magic. This is amazing. I'm like, I'm holding, it's sort of, it's almost like a leather bound. It looks like it might be bound in vinyl, but it it's like an official looking tome that one would experience in sort of like a Harry Potter world. It's really cool.
That was exactly the assignment. Any sort of text that they wanted, as long as it could appear on a witch's or wizard's bookshelf or not a bookshelf.
I want to say that I'm looking at a book on the history of Parseltongue that also has extensive marginalia, and it seems that the owner of this book disagrees with many of the conclusions of the author, and it is fascinating just to flip through. Yeah, they're just like things scribbled out and rewritten, and yeah, this is fun.
So, Rebecca, you have a book in front of you.
I have a couple, yeah.
Oh, you have a couple of books. They all look handmade. The first has a, that I'm looking at the top, says quite right, where quite and right seem to be cut out of, like, construction, like, each letter is an individually cut piece of construction paper.
Yeah.
Tell us about these.
Right. So these are final products from my most recent version of the class on the history and rhetoric of science writing for children. So that comes out of my own kind of personal training in children's literature. And so for the first half of the semester, the students worked mostly on digital artifacts. We did research on women who had written science texts in the 1800s and have gone largely unrecognized for their contributions to science. So they did original biographical research and then edited Wikipedia articles and a recovery project that I've been working with at the University of Florida about the women and the information that they found. So then the second half of the semester, I wanted to move them out of the digital and into the physical. And so we partnered with the office on campus, Serve, Learn, Sustain, and Seismic, and worked with a local elementary school. And so for this class, they worked with Centennial Academy, which is literally kind of two blocks that way across the street. And my students created from scratch picture books about something having to do with their major here at Georgia Tech. And so I gave them very specific parameters as to what a children's picture book looks like. So there are 32 pages. They have, you know, a series of double spreads. They have a cover and inside flyleaf pages. They need to have, you know, a title page. They need to have a page of acknowledgments and copyright. And then from there on out, I said, the sky's the limit. It has to be something that has to do with what you want to study or what you want to be when you grow up. And it needs to be written for an audience of K through 2 students. So they came together, they put together their drafts. I had them do picture book dummies in class, which are also physical objects of, you know, loose leaf paper mostly. And they peer reviewed those and they worked on those. And then as they got about halfway through the project, we walked over one morning to Centennial, and they each got a classroom full of kids. Some of them got kindergartners, first graders, or second graders. And there were two or three of them per class, and they said, I'm writing a picture book. Here's what it's about. Here's what my stuff looks like. Here's what writing a book looks like. And these young kids told them what they thought of their drafts and told them what they thought of their illustrations and told them what they thought of the story they were coming up with and gave them feedback on their stuff in progress. We also worked with the amazing folks at the Paper Museum who gave us lessons on paste paper making, which a lot of them used as background textures and illustrations, and then book binding. And so they got some lessons on how to put books together. And then we did a day at the Paper Museum where the K through 2 students came to the Paper Museum, they got a tour of the Paper Museum, they got to make paper, and then they sat with my students and read their final picture books with them. And so again, got kind of feedback on the finished product. And so, let's see, Corey, you are holding a book that's, yeah, go ahead. You
can... Oh no, I'm holding a book about the Flint water crisis that's written in verse. And there are moments that are, it almost pops out, so there's a, I'm looking at a page with a glass of water that seems clear, but then you can peel back the pages and see the lead molecules in the glass of water.
And that glass of water, this is paste paper, the texture they made at the Paper Museum and then scanned it into the computer to create that effect.
That is wild.
So the thing that makes the bubbles. And so in addition to the physical objects, the students then were also
working on their oral nonverbal communication because they had to go and present this, right? They had to read it. And we had long conversations in class about how do you hold a picture book? How do you make sure that the kids that you're talking to are interacting with the picture book? Where do you, you know, how do you get a small child to interact with this? Do you do this? Do you hold it out and let them do it? Are you sitting next to them? Where do you pause in the story? How do you negotiate the page turn? Do you build that physical motion into that? Can that help you build suspense? Can, you know, the page turn itself can be a moment of drama and then you see the result, right? And they really embraced that as a form and the way that that worked with the affordances of a picture book.
So it sounds like what I really liked about your assignment is the fact that your students had to present these to the audience
yes.
that they were intended
yes.
for. And it does seem that all of these projects, what is so interesting about them is that they invite this really expansive consideration of audience
yeah.
that's beyond just sort of like, I'm writing a paper for my professor
right.
or something like that. That, you know, all arguably like anything you produce within any class, you should be proud of, you should conceive it as truly communicating
mm-hmm.
something. And it is interesting the way that I do think these physical objects, in addition to sort of the very immediate reasoning of wanting to show all the ways that you can communicate,
mm-hmm.
they actually really require students to think seriously about the kinds of means that they utilize to actually do that.
And there's a lot of conversation that we had. So this particular section in the fall, I had students, they took their picture books home over Thanksgiving, a lot of them. And, you know, I was like, hey, this is a great time to raid your parents' cabinets. And, you know, I brought tons of construction paper and markers and crayons. But I think a lot of them said, like, oh, I grabbed a needle and thread while I was home for Thanksgiving. But a lot of them came back and said, you know, you talked about this as an opportunity to practice talking about what I do to non-experts. Thanksgiving went way better this year than it has in the past because I could turn to, you know, Uncle George and say, oh, this is what I'm doing at Georgia Tech.
Mm.
And hey, I'm even putting together this picture book. And suddenly that conversation was not, oh, okay, whatever. But more like, oh, that's really interesting. That's really cool. And so we talked in class about how this attention to non-expert audiences would have ramifications on their professional careers, right? Writing grants,
mm-hmm.
Writing proposals, going to interviews where you're interviewing not with the head of the team that you're going to be on, but the head of the company who might not really understand the area of science that you're in. And so you need to be able to take what you're doing and explain it in a way that's smart but also accessible. And so I think they really understood that. But then I said, you also need to be able to go to a cocktail party and be introduced to someone. And they say, oh, what do you do? If they don't understand the next 10 words that come out of your mouth, that conversation is over. And so you need to be able to pitch, oh, I am a biomedical engineer. I design devices to help children who have lung problems. Right, like that is an explanation that is clear and understandable and straightforward,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the language a lot of them get used to using when they're only also talking to other BME majors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if only all biomedical engineers went through this thought process and could conceptualize what it is that they're doing in this way.
I think you should do this workshop for all academics.
I think it would be valuable.
I would take this workshop
yeah.
so that I could talk to my family at Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Absolutely. This is great. Thank you all so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For coming in and showing this stuff up. We're going to put links to some of your student examples up on the website. You can also, as Courtney mentioned, see a great like shadow box display of some of these Harry Potter objects in the
mine are down there as well.
Bottom floor of Clough. Oh, thank you.
I have picture books down
there
as
right.
well.
Yes. So see both of these in the bottom floor of Clough or on their personal websites, which you can get to from Textile.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So thanks
yeah.
again.
Thank,
thank
you.
You.
Right.
Thank you, guys.
Pleasure being here.
Okay, so we're back with the second segment of our conversation about building things with your students. And we're here with a fellow first-year Brit, a cohort mate of
Jonathan. Yes, that's
and I,
true.
Katie Schlag.
Hello.
And Katie's going to help us transition from paper to plastic because we heard a lot about some really great
homemade books made with help from Georgia Tech Paper Museum. Katie taught an entire class about plastics. So would you talk to us a little bit about this class and sort of what your students did with this?
Yes. So this was a class I taught at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the English department as an advanced literature seminar. And the core topic of the course was looking at the material and metaphorical significance of plastic in American culture. And so kind of a good starting point is thinking about materials like Tupperware and Sculpey and how these materials that really sort of took off in the 1950s but start in the early 20th century begin to sort of redefine American culture, everything from interior design to entertainment to kind of every facet of everyday life. And then from those very kind of material objects like clothing, mass-produced commodities, we also started to look at the way that plastic influences American sense of identity. So things like self-transformation, self-help, the American dream in terms of kind of infinite possibilities and transformability. All of those ideas we can link with plastic as a material and what Bart kind of wanted to call it sort of infinite moldability, this idea that anything is possible. Plastic transcends the limitation of wood, of metal, of paper, of, you know, geological formulations. Plastic can become anything that you want it to be. And so we were interested in exploring kind of the sort of pleasures and pitfalls of this cultural phenomenon. Plastic is, of course, the ultimate agent of environmental destruction by many accounts. So we're producing things that do not decay. So it's interesting that in some ways we're sort of living out our vicarious fantasy of immortality through these materials that will ultimately destroy us. And so I didn't approach the class as a sort of typical, you know, climate change lit class or environmental lit class, although we did have those perspectives. It was much more inflected with like a queer and feminist analysis point because we were interested in thinking about how ideas of nature kind of juxtaposed with the artificial tend to end up being sort of exclusionary and purist. So thinking about things like artificial limbs, more different materials, silicone, and the things that that has enabled. I'm thinking about ways that women, queer people, people of color have actually been empowered by the products that plastic has been able to generate. And so for students, they were encouraged to really think about all of the plastic objects that populate their daily lives. So everything from their favorite pen to their ID card to maybe their collection of makeup brushes. So all of the things that you don't think about that are a little bit less obvious than maybe the plastic bag at the grocery store or the water bottle that you want to recycle. And so one of the assignments I had students do was that they would bring in a plastic object that they felt some particular attachment to, and they would do a research presentation on it where they would think about what is the history of this object, where did it originate from before it was plastic, because often, like, you know, you have a wooden comb and then that becomes a plastic comb. And then they would give us more information, like, about the actual chemical breakdown, like, is this polyethylene, is this polypropylene, what difference does that make? And think about the cultural significance of this thing. And we would pass it around in class. We'd all sort of touch the object, feel its weight and its texture and its color, and kind of trying to suspend for a moment the ultimate instinct, which is that it's bad that these things exist, which we all sort of know, kind of opening ourselves up to the fact that we do have affective attachments, like your favorite outfit is probably made out of plastic, things like that. So it was this interesting space of being critical, but also kind of being open or not like denying other impulses that might be there. And that was a lot.
Well, I like it. I mean, it's an interesting stance. I think in certain ways, when I was originally thinking and approaching this topic about material objects in the classroom or building stuff or building them in related to communication, I was coming from this position that material construction was a kind of novelty to utilize or to even think about. Whereas what I am intrigued by with your class is you're sort of demonstrating the ways in which this kind of materiality or this kind of construction, particularly with the material of plastic, is absolutely ubiquitous in all things. And so in a certain way, contending with material objects is almost like contending with the very real of communication in a ways that, you know, by comparison, more abstract forms like writing or speech is not.
Right, yeah, yeah. And we were definitely kind of invested in thinking through that distinction and whether it actually holds up. So in my classroom, I allow laptops. And so every day sitting around the tables, everyone would be on their laptop. And there's this sense that if you're using your laptop, it's environmentally friendly because you're not printing off paper, but you're still using energy, which, you know, comes from coal. Like, all of this is related. Laptop parts are produced using plastic. You're still using Microsoft Word in an electronic form, you know, before you produce your essay. So yeah, we were really interested and thinking about how this is already around us all the time. We don't exist in some disembodied space. We exist in a physical space. We're using physical tools, almost all of which are informed by plastic. And so it did become this kind of opening up of this perspective. And their final assignment was actually to create a visual essay primarily using digital tools, a digital visual essay. And then they had the option to create a tactile or embodied component. It was not required, but several students really gravitated towards that option, I think because of the semester-long engagement with objects, always passing them around in classroom and kind of considering them, I think pushed them to want to engage beyond the digital framework.
So say more about that. I mean, this is what I'm really sort of curious about is, as you put it, having this tactile element in class. I mean, what would you, how would you say this element sort of enhances or changes a class versus, say, you could have the same class about plastics mm-hmm. in which you read from a sort of eco-critical lens about the dangers of plastics, as you sort of prefaced earlier. But I am really curious to hear what it is about sort of introducing physical elements at all times that changes the nature of the classroom and the learning experience.
Yeah, I think that any sort of kinesthetic engagement or tactile engagement works on the brain and works on the learning process in a different way. And so the sort of traditional kind of sedentary model of sitting in a particular place and reading and talking, and really kind of the only part of the body you're engaging is your brain and your mouth and throat muscles, that's one thing, and a lot of good learning can take place. But I think once you're moving around the classroom, once you're actually touching things, kind of engaging with your environment in a different way, it triggers different sensory mechanisms, which then also can instigate different kinds of learning. And so it's one thing to speak abstractly about objects in our lives, but if we actually had some around the table right now, well, here's one, here's a pen. So we could pass this pen around. I also see a cell phone, a computer, a piece of paper. I'm wearing a pair of plastic galoshes, which I sort of love because I wanted a pair of rainproof galoshes for a long time and I finally got them, and they're terrible, but they're gorgeous. So actually having concrete examples, I think, gave the students something more real to latch onto. And it's really about giving ideas form. So for me, it's like this oscillation between theory and practice, or between idea and material. And in a way, that sort of format of the classroom really embodied the key point of the class, which was plastic does kind of operate in this weird space where it's very material, it's all about materialism, but at the same time it embodies all of these ideas about like infinity and, you know, multiplicity and plenitude and all of this. So I wanted them to really kind of live in that space where they're able to make things concrete. And I think it just makes it more relatable. They started sending emails to the class list about like a manicure that they had seen or a new ban on plastic straws that they had noticed. They started talking about in daily check-ins like how they were engaging with these objects in their daily lives outside of the classroom too. One of the examples was the paper or plastic at the grocery store. There are a lot of different examples. So I think it just really helped them connect it to their daily lives, which is useful in the context of any class, so that students are making these connections all the time and their brains are working outside of class, and it's kind of this continual churning of like integrating the course material into their sort of everyday processing of information, which I think promotes deeper learning.
And you sent us a link ahead of time with some student examples, but would you like to describe maybe one of your favorites or a couple of your favorites, sort of some of these physical objects that were built out of this assignment that didn't necessarily require the production of physical objects?
Yeah, and so one of my students, Alex Mishler, sculpted an albatross out of plastic, and it was inspired by an essay by Allison Cobb, which was called Plastic and Autobiography, and it was ultimately about an albatross that had died by consuming too much plastic from the ocean. And so it's a really, really sad story, and it's sort of a testament to, you know, environmental destruction and how it affects animals. And so Alex, who was a sculptor and a carpenter, was used to working with traditional materials like wood. And He applied those techniques to actually melt down, I believe it was high-density polyethylene, which is primarily found in milk jugs. And so he created an instructable page to kind of document his process for other makers, craftspeople online. And so that was sort of one component of the assignment. And he went through this experimental process of how to melt down this plastic and then use it as a raw material from which he ultimately sculpted the albatross. And it was interesting because plastic as a material really resists human craftsmanship. It has a sheen. It has a gloss. It doesn't really betray any traces of its making. And through melting it down and then carving it by hand, Alex found that it had these interesting textures and kind of traces of his craftsmanship that wouldn't have been evident in many other plastic objects you would buy. And so kind of by actually working with the material, he was also able to meditate on the albatross's death and what it meant to actually be sort of memorializing this creature in the material that ultimately killed it. So it was this very bittersweet kind of resonant inquiry that he was able to do with the skill he already had and then sort of applying it to these materials. So I thought that was really cool.
So are most of the projects like the one you just described from Alex, are most of these sort of creative artistic pieces or like sculptures, or do they take other forms?
Yeah, so the project, they were really encouraged to sort of combine creative and critical analysis. So like in Alex's case, he also did write a visual essay that critiqued and analyzed every step of his process. So the instructable was public facing for actual crafters, and then the visual essay was for the context of the class. Another example, another student, Catherine Drena, created plastic seashell assemblages. So she found seashells and other beach detritus on like toothbrushes and other kind of plastic objects left behind, and then combine them into these little sculptural formations and arrange them like chemical formulas. She was inspired by Evelyn Riley's experimental poetry book, Styrofoam, in which she kind of creates different polystyrene chemical formulations as part of the visual poetry. And then she created a visual essay incorporating these photographs of the sculptures that she made. So it's kind of this multi-layer process that you're working with these tactile objects, and then you can incorporate that back into the digital zine. And then she also printed that as a booklet. So I'm really interested, too, in that kind of playful transfer or oscillation again between the tactile and the digital. It's not like one project is exclusively either or. I think it can feed into the other.
And I think you've also mentioned to me that some of these are zines.
Right, yeah. And so some students were really interested in kind of the new sort of influx of DIY zine making culture. I think that because everything is so digital now, a lot of students have sort of this nostalgia for something that you can actually pick up, like a book or a zine, something that is handmade. And so one of my students, Adi, Dina, was interested in kind of troubling or critiquing this sort of seamless sheen of plastic and photography. So she printed off her zine on matte paper intentionally, so not glossy, it was matte. And then she hand sewed it and left the thread really visible. And it was kind of trying to, again, sort of disrupt the seamless sheen. Whereas another student, Catherine Torner, actually wanted to maintain this sheen, like a high quality, like Vogue magazine or other fashion magazine. And so when she printed off the booklet, she made it high gloss paper, and everything about the magazine kind of was situated within that context of like letters to the editor, advertisements, all of the different layout spreads. And it really did kind of imitate the form perfectly. And in that regard, she wanted to embed her critique sort of within the context that you would usually encounter something maybe uncritical. And so she was kind of sort of sneaking in a feminist critique into the sort of fashion context, whereas Adi was more kind of wanting to foreground the matter, like disruption. And then another student, Savannah Staus, actually was also interested in critiquing the seamless sheen of specifically sex robots. And so she wrote to the Real Doll Factory, which produces basically sex dolls who they're now embedding with artificial intelligence. And Savannah said she wanted a skin sample, and these Real Dolls, their skin is made out of silicone, one of the main materials we studied. And she pretended that she was interested in purchasing a doll so that they would send her a skin sample, and they did. They sent her about a 4x4 chunk of purple flesh, which ended up basically being, you know, feeling like rubber. And so Savannah actually sewed this chunk of flesh into her zine, which had a lot of other tactile materials too, but actually touching the so-called skin of one of these dolls was a really kind of fascinating way to engage with this. And it made it so much more real, looking at the doll on a computer screen versus actually touching this thing that is supposed to simulate human flesh.
So I'm curious, I have to ask Katie, since we as Britain Fellows both teach the technical communication classes here. And on one hand, you know, one might hear about the work you did in this class on plastics and think, that this might have little relation to something like technical communications, or at least technical communications in certain current forms. A lot of things that students are creating now are digital. They're going into industries that will primarily be interested in creating digital projects. I'm curious if you could say something about how these concepts that you've talked about still apply to these kinds of realms.
Yeah, and I think that in each of these projects, you know, there is a technical communication component there. So like Catherine Torner, the student who created the very realistic glossy magazine, that's certainly a technical communication context where she was able to kind of perfectly situate this very specific kind of letter to the editor, all of these different genres within the magazine, which would be very applicable to a workplace communication situation. Savannah had to write to the Real Doll factory and craft an email that would get the results she wanted, which she was able to do. Alex's instructable page was very, very different than the visual essay he ultimately wrote for the class. It was very rhetorically aware of the crafts audience that he was speaking to because he was already engaged in that community as someone who was always making DIY crafts and art projects. So yeah, I think that there's a lot of commonality. And in the technical communication class I'm teaching now for computer science students, which you are as well, Jonathan, so you already know this, but that students are creating paper prototypes. And so even though they're creating software ultimately and digital apps, it's really useful for them to be able to brainstorm on paper and to be able to create things that users can test in that paper way, because it's a little bit, I think, more engaging often for users. And also you can test something before you make it in the digital form.
There's a way too, I think, when they make the physical paper prototypes, you notice that there's a lot of design aesthetics that are communicated to the digital, but that are essentially reflections of physical, sort of mm-hmm. the way appearances exist in a physical state. So like the casting of shadows
right.
or the appearance of depth that you might give buttons is something that ideally, if you see it in a kind of physical, a real physical presence, only enhances your ability to translate it to a digital space.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, like the digital realm is sort of always defining itself against the tactile, but it is so inextricably sort of
it's very much like a reflection of
yeah.
the tactile. That sounds really right.
So okay, to bring our longer conversation full circle, have you seen this cartoon that's in the copy room and intern office in Hall Building?
I actually have not seen it. I'm looking at it now. I loved your description of it. Your description of it was very vivid. Okay, now I'm looking at it. This is funny.
So you have to decide which panel you are
yeah.
or which panel
okay.
this
which of these students
you.
Is in your class and why?
So my Georgia Tech students or the student from my plastic class at UW.
If the answer is different, then I want to know both answers.
Okay. I would say the students from my plastic class, it's probably the balancing the teacups one.
Okay.
Yeah, because I like that we talked a lot about performance art, and I feel like that's what this student is doing. The sort of very embodied balancing act with kind of multiple components. So I'd like to think that the student is enjoying themselves. They were one of my students. At Georgia Tech, I would say it's probably the student carrying the poster board because of the paper prototyping. We also have them do a lot of activities using post-it notes on big sketch paper. And so that's actually another kind of embodied kinesthetic thing. A way I kind of carry that forward here is kind of getting them to brainstorm collectively in this very kind of fast and furious fun way that is a little bit more engaging than if they were all individually sitting on their laptops. So yeah, poster board and teacup would be my kind of understanding of my student
one class. Paper, one plastic.
Yes,
plastic
teacups, paper, poster board.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for sharing.
Thank
with
you
us.
So much. This was wonderful. Thank you.
What cool projects. Thanks.
Thank you.
Comic, it definitely seems like English classes are so weird at Tech. But I mean, if you really sit and think about it, it's an opportunity to like change from everything we've done like in high school and whatnot, which is like sitting and writing papers day in and day out. And now we can do something with our hands and make something material that we're actually really, really proud of and something we can, like, actually, like, put our a part of us into. And I think that's, like, what sets it apart. Like, I've written papers forever, and, like, I don't keep any of them. But I would rather keep a project I made with my hands than, like, a paper I wrote, like, probably the night before.